Hello and welcome to another episode of Material Matters with Grant Gibson. I've done more than 100 shows now. However, for listeners who might be new to all this, the idea is that I speak to a designer, maker, artist or architect about a material or technique with which they're intrinsically linked and discover how it changed their lives and careers. Before we get going, I wanted to point you in the direction of an award-winning podcast from this episode's sponsor, the American Hardwood Export Council. Words on Wood is a collaboration with design magazine Disenio and is a wide-ranging exploration of all things wood-related, from forestry and processing to design and disposal. Venturing into the world's forests and sites of timber production, as well as design and architecture studios, the podcast examines how multiple industries intersect through a single material. The fall season opened recently with an in-depth exploration of an often overlooked and misunderstood timber product, veneer. It also sees the introduction of a new bite-sized episodes, Making Shorts, which shines a light on the different techniques for designing and building with timber. You can find Words on Wood on your usual streaming platforms. Safe to say, I'm a fan. Right, so this festive episode is slightly different because as we come to the end of 2023, I thought it'd be interesting to talk to someone who's had a breakthrough year. And I couldn't think of anyone that description fits better than the excellent Simone Brewster. In June, Simone had her first solo exhibition at the Now Gallery on the Greenwich Peninsula, entitled The Shape of Things. While in September, her installation Spirit of Place with Cork Company Emporium opened on the Strand in the centre of London. These came with what amounts to a blizzard of publicity, including a profile in the New York Times. In short, she's been hard to avoid. Simone, how are you? Thank you very much for doing this.
Yeah, hi. That's a nice introduction. Thank you.
Oh, good. Was it reasonably accurate?
It was very accurate. It's been a crazy few months, yeah.
I mean, we're recording this deep, deep into September, and it should be released before the end of the year.
Yeah.
So I've got to ask you, plans for Christmas?
Sleep. Can I sleep, please?
Yeah, you can.
Am I allowed? Yeah. I don't know. My son might have something to say to it. He did last night. But yeah, I'll be looking forward to getting a bit of rest. And I have a few projects lined up for next year. But in honesty, I'm really looking forward to sleeping. It's my biggest project.
Sleep for Christmas. The gift that Santa can bring you.
Exactly. It's the project I haven't been able to crack so far this year. And it's the one I want to really get under my belt before next year.
Okay. Good. We'll bear this in mind. We won't disturb you during Christmas.
Nice.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you had your show, The Shape of Things, at the Now Gallery, Greenwich Peninsula. You've also had this significant project with the Cork Company Emporium on the Strand.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think this has been a breakthrough year for you?
It's been a bit of a crazy one. It's been full on. And what's really funny for me is I did intend to get stuff done in the last 12-15 months, but the scale of what I've been doing has been bigger than I expected. My son now, I was pregnant at the start of the majority of these projects, and it's like everyone waited for me to get pregnant to decide to offer me this like huge opportunities. And I was like, okay, I'll just roll with it. I'll do it. And because I normally just do it and figure it out. And I thought, okay, I'll do it. And when I took on the project for Now Gallery, I thought, you know, I'll have this opportunity. You put forward a concept, and my concept was mainly almost like a retrospective. It was like most of my work was existing, and I came up with a concept for the space and handed it over to them. And I won the project. And I was like, great, I've won it, because then I can just like put in all this work that I've got, and I can still spend time with my son. And they came back and were like, oh, you won. But yeah, we just want these two existing projects and everything else has to be new. And I was like, okay, that's going to be. So it's been, that was the start of my relaxing maternity. It's been great and I can't really complain, in honesty. It's been kind of phenomenal.
I mean, what The Shape of Things does or did is allow an audience to look at a body of your work. I'm interested, did you learn something about your practice as you were putting the show together?
I knew some things about my practice before, and I was given the opportunity to iron out some things. And it was really, so what was really, you know, helpful for me was actually having the opportunity to work with the gallery themselves, because you talk to creative people all the time. Normally we live in a bubble or in our own little cave somewhere. And occasionally we show the rest of the world what we've been up to. And I've got a few corners in my cave where I make all these different things or produce all these different things. And I showed the gallery and they were like, yeah. Basically, when I won the bid, they were like, we need to find a way to cut some of this out. And the project of communicating what you do is the project. And that's actually true. Just became a really good opportunity to kind of talk to other people and really get clear on how to communicate what I'm doing with my practice, because it has a few different arms. And so, yeah, I had the opportunity to reflect and really think about, why are people confused? You know, not confused, but what kind of makes them wonder what I'm doing, and how can I give them the opportunity to understand what's going on in my brain a little bit and understand how these different practices are actually one practice and how everything connects. And then I had the opportunity to come up with the concept for the space, design all of the way that everything was going to be presented. And most people, when they get the opportunity to work with galleries, they don't get the opportunity to be in the driving seat as much as I was. So I was really grateful for, let's say, the trust they're putting me to put on that show. So that was great.
It had interactivity as well.
It did. But that's because I used to teach for so long and they wanted interactivity.
So what could people do there?
There were two kind of things that I was thinking when I was coming up with the concept of the space, other than how do I present the work, is that we want people to actually come in. Mm. And gallery spaces are often very, they can be very intimidating to people who don't normally live in that world. Like, we live in a world where we have a language, we have a way of dressing, we have, there are all these codes, right? And if you're not from that world, it can be really tough just to pass the threshold and enter a space that looks like all of those things are super expensive, or all those things are presented in a way that I don't think I understand what's going on. So when I was designing a space, one of the things I wanted to do is make it feel like people should come into the space. And I'd done that partially using color. Color was one of the big things. So when you walk past, it was like bright and it was welcoming and it was summer and it was fun. So that was one of the ways to get them through the door. And then one of the big learnings, or one of the most important things for me as a practitioner when I was in teaching at university, was how do you close the circle for people? Because people were inundated with what creativity is from the outside world. You go on Instagram and everyone's showing you, and that's great in one way, but it can also close you off from your own creativity. You can feel shut down almost sometimes by the overwhelming input that we have. So I wanted people to be in this space to see what I was about, and then have a zone where they could almost sit down and close the circle by doing something themselves. And I remember in the run-up, the gallery were like, so how are we going to give instructions? We need them. Can we just put those stamps there? Don't we need some kind of game or a set of rules or things like instructions? And it was almost like, we could do that, or we could just put some paper down and just leave the stamps and see what happens.
So people could create their own stamps. That was the thing, right?
Yeah. They could use the stamps and do their own designs, their own pattern. And in the end, we went with the let's just see what happens approach. And I think that was the right approach, because it meant that any age group, like you had really young children who could just about hold it playing. And then you had, you know, full grown adults playing. And I think that was one of the most joyous parts of the show, actually, the stamps. It really made people connect with their own creativity, which is great. Mm.
There were several things that you noticed about your work, and among the people that came in and interacted with it when you walked into the gallery. And I mean, you've alluded to it already. One of them was this ability to shift disciplines from furniture to jewellery to painting. We'll talk about this, I imagine, a bit later, but you come from an architecture background. And the official blurb from the Now Gallery says the show explored what it describes as intimate architecture, which is quite an intriguing phrase. So is it all architecture to you?
That's a good point. And I think in a way it is. And I say unfortunately, because it's almost like I can't leave that part of me behind. And it's the foundation of my entire creative education. I think of architecture as the start point to everything else. It's where I learned how to actually, if I'm honest, how to survive as a creative individual, because it was a tough time. It's a hard course. And we learn things that at the time, you didn't even realize you were learning that will become applicable later, like how to talk even, you know, doing a crit and having to stand up in front of people who are then going to tell you how good or how rubbish, normally how rubbish for me, your project was. You have to learn how to articulate yourself and how to present your work and your ideas succinctly and, and communicate through your design as well. So beyond the kind of principles of architecture, what is architecture when you break it down into it? As when I was teaching, I'd say it's raw ingredients. The ingredients of space. Beyond learning that, I think it taught me how to kind of take myself seriously, which is something that one of my tutors said to me, do you take yourself seriously, in a tutorial? And it stayed with me my whole life, pretty much. Yeah.
So you do take yourself seriously now?
I think I have to respect that I'm asking other people to respect my work, and therefore I have to respect it myself first if I'm going to do that. And that's that took me a moment when he said that to me. When I forgot, and I think in my career I have forgot the importance of that, I've been reminded that it's extremely important.
Interesting. When you're shifting from painting to jewellery, does your brain have to shift, or is it the same thought process?
It's the same brain. I think
it's the same brain.
It's literally, it's the same one in my head. But I know the root of your question is kind of, is based in very much a now question, I think of it. Like in our times, we very much think of creative individuals as niching in and being known for one thing. And it's strange, or it's looked on as strange when we don't do that. And I remember when I graduated from the RCA and talking about, because my final project had many different arms to it. It had ceramic cups, it had cutlery, it had a chair, it had quite a few things. And the person I spoke to, oh, you just don't know what you're doing then. And I was like, yeah, in a way I do know what I'm doing. But I think that people are not used to it. So it's the same brain and it's all connected. It's just engaging maybe with a different question or a different way of expressing an answer. And to add to that, I guess my husband showed me a few weeks ago a talk. It was a TED talk, and it was about someone looking at the term. I'm going to try and look it up now, or maybe you can. It was called slow multitasking. It was a TED talk on slow multitasking, and I can't remember the name of the person because I'm not good with names. But his whole theory was that if you look at creativity and people, not just in the design field but across disciplines, historically, that they were not just focused in on one thing at one time. They were often looking at multiple things. And that enabled them to unstick themselves when they found that they were finding something too difficult, because they'd give themselves time and space in another area, and it would dislodge whatever was holding them up in that area. And that's actually what I realized I've been doing my whole career. It's like when I get a bit stuck with furniture, I just decide to do a bit of jewelry. And when I got stuck with jewelry, I just ended up writing in my diary. And then when it was COVID and we got stuck in our houses, I ended up painting.
Well, I was going to ask you about the painting, because I've known your work for, you know, quite a long time.
A while, yeah.
A while. But the painting was relatively new to me, and this was a pandemic thing.
It was when we were just stuck in our houses, literally. And it started because every Wednesday, me and my partner, my boyfriend at the time, he's now my husband, I upgraded him. we used to decide to do something.
Lucky him.
Yeah, he's
all very, I can exactly. Say. Yeah.
We decided to do something fun and different and, you know, make sourdough or blah, blah, blah. And then it came to a point and it was like, when I was retired, I really wanted to paint, and he painted a bit. And I said, can you teach me how to paint? So it was like a date night thing. And we started to paint. Yeah, literally. And I started to paint. And he kept on saying to me, over, and I enjoyed it. So we'd done it more than once. And he kept on saying to me, no, no, Simone, you're trying to paint like me. Just paint like yourself. You know those sketches you were doing? And you know that, and he kept on saying, more like you, more like you. And I just kept on going. And eventually, you know, started to do these paintings based on work ideas that I couldn't do in the workshop. But, you know, it was to do with a continuation of the Negress and Mammy pieces, these kind of deconstructed female forms. And I started to do these kind of paintings of deconstructed female bodies and look around the ideas that were going with that. And it was also the time of the artist support pledge. So I was like, yeah, why not? I'm so used to not sharing work until I feel like it's ready. And I said, no, you know what? You're always saying to people that it's a journey and a process. So just share it, whatever. Don't take it too seriously. And it got this quite positive response really quickly. And I was surprised by that. And it kind of encouraged me to keep going. And so I did. Yeah, it's been great.
Mm. Yeah. And the combs. Can we talk about the combs? Because they seem to encapsulate quite a lot of the thinking that's going on behind your work, which is to do with race, to do with gender, to do with visibility.
Mm.
And it seems to me they're kind of critical while being celebratory at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. They were fun. They were a whole project in their own right. And yeah, so for anyone who didn't see the show, there are three combs near the entrance. And alongside the combs, they're shown alongside these kind of traditional African hairstyles, which I think most people haven't actually seen. A lot of people are like, wow, I've never seen those kind of hairstyles. They're really sculptural, and they really are. And the combs were, as you said, you've done a good introduction, actually. They're kind of celebratory. The shapes and forms that I've used, if you think of like a traditional Afro comb, it's kind of based on that, but it's scaled up. They're quite big. They're made in, two of them were made in mango wood and sapele, and one of them was just mango wood. And it's like I wish I made them a bit bigger, almost, so that they were like small figures. But they've got this kind of language of these hairstyles and the suggestion to, well, the history of the Afro comb, which in itself is a kind of an object of protest. And there's a few things going on in there. And they're handmade, which was at the time was the biggest joke and nightmare of the show, because I was doing these paintings and I was doing these jewelry pieces. And I said to myself at the time, I don't actually want to make the combs. I just want to send them out to be CNC'd somewhere, and then I can hand finish them and assemble them, whatever. And I don't have to think about it. I'll source the material and I'll do all of that. And it was just like, no one would do it. They were just the wrong size. There were two, and they were more complicated for a machine than I thought they would be, because they were different in all that, like in the X axes and the Y axes, and the Z axes were all different. So you needed like a 5 mil axes to mill, and it just became this nightmare. And we had very short time. The show was approaching, and everyone was panicking. Simone, you still haven't made these combs that you proposed. And I remember going to visit Max Lam and Gemma Holt. They were in my year when I was at the RCA, and I went to visit them. They live just near my sister, so I see them whenever I'm going to visit her, pretty much. And I'm saying to them, this is a nightmare. I literally can find no one to produce it. And Max was like, oh, you can come use my workshop. So I went over, and he's got an amazing workshop. It's like the dream. And so I went over, literally, I was just like, yes, went over and ended up just making it in like a day and a half. It was super straightforward. Once you have Max's workshop, you can make anything. You can do it in a day and a half.
Bear that in mind, everyone. You need Max's workshop.
It's amazing. Yeah.
I mean, the two pieces that I guess are discussed the most, Negress and Mammy, chaise longue and a side table respectively. I mean, Negress is described by Now Gallery as, and I'm going to quote, a modernist perspective on a deconstructed view of the black female body, referencing and questioning the primitivist and the cubist interpretation of the subject.
Yeah.
Is that how you'd describe it?
It's not wrong. It's just a lot, isn't it? It's a bit like what we were talking about before, why people don't go into galleries. You need a lot. You almost need a degree to understand what's being said there. So if we break it down into just normal. So what happened when I was made? There's a whole... I remember when I started to show this piece and the feedback made me write an entire blog post on this. And it's basically, I remember going to the V&A, so I'm not answering your story quite directly, but I'm telling you.
Okay. Well, you go the route you want to go.
Yeah, where it came from. Going to the V&A, seeing, they had these kind of, they were very small figurines. There were sugar holders and there were like black women figurine sugar holders, and they would normally be presented on a table. At the time they were made, they would be presented on a table and it'd be by plantation owners to kind of tell everyone that their money came from the sugar plantations. And I love the V&A, but I was like, this is one of the only representations of like black female and blackness in the museum. And it's an object that talks about boasting about this position that this person has. And then it kind of reminded me of other things that I've thought about when I've been looking at work, how objects tell stories about us. We own objects to tell stories about ourselves that reinforce them to ourselves and show them to other people. And I ended up wanting to kind of talk about the position of black women and the position of black women at that time, that they were basically holding up this system, this structure, and being oppressed by it. So I designed this chair that you sit on, and the elements that hold up the chair are cut up pieces of a black female form. And they're deconstructed because they're cut up, and they're kind of simplified into a minimalist forms, but you can still read that that's kind of a form of a head, that's a breast, that's another breast, that's a leg. And it's acting as a structure, but within it, it becomes something else. And actually, to be fair, when I made it, I knew I wanted it to say certain things, but I don't even think I understood the fullness of how it came together, that if you use it as an object, if you sit on it, you're taking part in the oppression of the body.
I was going to ask about that because, funnily enough, my next question was going to be about the importance of function, but you've sort of answered it. So the function, the fact it is a seat,
yeah,
and people are going to sit on it,
right,
is completely vital to the piece.
That's right. So what happens is it becomes an artwork, but it only becomes an artwork through being a furniture piece.
Mm.
And that is when it gets really interesting. And that's something that only happened, like the concept and the intent and the narrative were all there in my brain. But when it came into reality, I saw the full circle and I said, no, that becomes even more powerful then. I guess that's one of the things I like about making work, because actually you always think you know as the maker, and you can even have the whole story in your head, but the story is only complete when it's out in the real world.
You made it well before the murder of George Floyd and the rise of Black Lives Matter. And how was it received when you launched it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And that's kind of where I stand with my work, is that it's been really interesting seeing this movement, this more public shift. But that's always been my work in a way. What I call my real work has always been in that position. At the time, I think people respect, like, it was a well-made object. It's also kind of beautiful in its own right. And I feel like people respected it, but they didn't know what to do with it. And I think that's more to do with me at the time. I think I would have been maybe 26, 28, somewhere between, so probably 27. when that piece was first shown, and I thought at the time that it was a furniture piece, but then I realized with maturity and with, you know, when I started to write about this piece, it's an art piece in the furniture world. And that's why people in the furniture world don't really know what to do with it, because it's too loud. You know, we want our objects in the furniture, you know, in the product and furniture world, we want our objects to talk, but that piece is too loud and it's talking about things that are very difficult. And so I feel like it was kind of well received in terms of respect and, you know, the craftsmen, all of those things, but it was difficult for people to know what to do with it as well.
Mm. Is it an angry piece or a resigned piece?
When you realize it's like an artwork, it's about what you bring to the piece as much as what I'm putting out there. So as I said, even when I had the idea in my brain, I was like, I want to say this thing and I want to use a black female form and I want it to be like broken up and I want it to be a servant. So it has to be a piece of furniture because I want it to be a servant. But at the same time, I want it to... So I had all this narrative. But only when you put it in the real world, that's when the real... when you really understand. And that's actually what's really interesting about being a creative for me. It's like, I have an idea about a thing, a ring. And only when it's on a finger is it actually... really understood as a piece of jewelry, and does it do what I think it was going to do? That's important. That, and this is kind of the struggle of being a creative, is getting it into the real world, because we can normally shoot ourselves down before we bring it out or share it with people. But in actual fact, that's the only time your work is actually ever complete. And it's hard to do. It's hard to do that. It's why. Yeah, that's why I respect anyone who does do it. Even if you don't necessarily love the work, you have to respect the individual for putting themselves out there.
I'm quite interested, you said you wrote about Negris after you'd completed it. I mean, is that something you do with all your pieces?
No, it's just because so many people ask about this. There's so much, and people ask about, was I aware of? Was I intending that? And I like, there's a lot of intent there. I know why it's called the Negress. I know why it's called the Mammy. I know what it connects to. You know, very, very little was unintended. And I think the biggest learning was learning that work has context. So for me, it was like, this is a furniture piece, but the context is the art world.
Mm.
That was a lesson. But then I'm not from the art world. So it was also like, and then what do I do now? I've made an art piece that's quite powerful, but I don't know what to do with it because that's not my world.
I hope you're enjoying the show. I just want to say thank you to everyone who visited and exhibited at the Material Matters Fair in September. And of course, a huge thanks go to our headline sponsor, the lighting specialist, Bert Frank, as well as our other sponsors. The fair will return to Barge House, Oxo Tower Wharf, next September from the 18th to the 21st. If you're interested in exhibiting, do drop me a line at hello@materialmatters.design. That's hello@materialmatters.design. Look out for more news on exciting live events happening next year in the very near future. There's a quote I found interesting about you in a story in the New York Times, where Kirstine Martin, who is the director of projects at the London Design Festival, she also works on the Material Matters Fair, I should add, says there's a maternal energy to a lot of your work. Mm. Do you see that?
Maybe. It's really interesting because this is what I mean about putting your work into the world. People bring themselves to it as well, right?
Mm.
And at times it definitely is. I deal with a lot of female bodies, female forms, like there's actually loads of it in my work. It's everywhere. And so I've come to kind of accept that but because I actually want it to be there. I'm doing it on purpose half the time. So yeah, it's definitely part of my work. I don't know if it's always maternal. I'm not necessarily always talking about things from a maternal perspective, but I definitely think I'm engaged with the female perspective in my work. And I guess I'm always interested in people saying these kind of comments, because I remember when I graduated from the RCA, this is before I would say I did my real work, but I did have quite a large body of work as well. And seeing people refer to me as Simon Brewster in the press, because they'd probably gone on my website and read that I'd studied architecture, and then my forms are quite big and bold. And so people just assumed I was a man. until I started making jewellery, and then I was Simone Brewster, the jeweller. So there's something very interesting here about gender roles in how people perceive work. And as I said, to a degree, it is in my work and I do put it there, but I don't know if it's in my work as much as people perceive all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I met Omar at one of your openings that I went to.
Yeah.
Has becoming a mother affected your practice? It's not something I normally ask, but because I wouldn't ask a man, I don't think. But it has cropped up in pieces around your work.
It's definitely affected my practice. So in the preparation for the Now Gallery show, I had to have him strapped to my body. He was so young at the time, he couldn't walk and he wanted to be near me and I wanted to be near him. So I'd just strap him on my body and I could paint and he'd fall asleep. And it meant I could work and it meant he was close to me. So in a very physical way, that affected me, my back at least, but it affected my practice. And I would show him, you know, he's seen me painting since he was very, very young. But it's affected my, well, actually, I think it makes me want to advocate more for myself. I think that I was actually kind of chill before. And now I'm much more vocal. And maybe that sounds weird because maybe I've always seemed very vocal, but it feels like I want this to be normal. I've had so many women slip into my DMs and be like, Simone, how are you doing all of this? And it's like, the fact that this is shocking, that I'm making work in this phase, means that we should be talking about it, normalizing it, making it easier for women to still work through this phase, giving them the opportunities to work. That's actually the biggest thank you, is like, actually, that Now Gallery and London Design Festival still wanted to go forward with me, even then they knew I had a child, because I think normally they wouldn't do that. A lot of people wouldn't have done that. And I didn't let them down. I didn't let myself down. So we should be offering that to more women, I think.
Yeah. Well, you didn't let them down. I mean, should we talk about that other big project you did, which was the installation with the court company and Morim on the Strand in the centre of London? How did that come about?
They contacted me, London Design Festival. They actually contacted me when I was heavily, heavily pregnant the year before. And they were like, do you want to, because it was their 20th anniversary then. And they wanted me to do something for the 20th anniversary. And initially it was going to be in the V&A. And I wanted the courtyard in the middle. And I had a whole concept. I was like, I'm going to make 20 different chairs using cork. And we're going to have it in this space. And people can go in there and they can sit down, interact and blah, blah, blah. Like, I had a whole thing. And then Amarim were like, we love it. Now you have to come to the cork factories. And I was like, but have you seen my belly? I would have to go and get like a special sign off from the doctor. And so it ended up being delayed. I can't, I literally can't do that right now. I can't get a plane. I just need to not push this. And they were fine. They were like, absolutely fine. Let's circle back in a year's time. And I thought they'd forget about me. But then around December, Kirstine got in touch with me and was like, yeah, are you still up for doing that project that you said you were up for doing last year? Yeah, okay. Because they really wanted me to fly out and see the cork forest. That's the thing.
Yes.
That was the crux. It was like, we're happy to go ahead with this project, but you have to come and see the cork forest and you have to come and see our factories and how we do things.
Well, were you aware of cork's properties before the project started?
Some of them.
Yeah.
When I graduated, I wanted to do a project with cork, but I just wasn't able to pull it off. I couldn't find, that's when I realized that actually, why when I type in cork supplies, is everything Portuguese? So then I learned it's in Portugal. And I was like, my best friend is Portuguese. So I've been to Portugal many times, but I still didn't realize that actually the whole institution is pretty much there. There's a little bit in Italy, there's a little bit in Spain, but it's pretty much Portugal. And I didn't have the kind of, I don't know, I was very young. I think I graduated when I was 24. So I was around 24 and I just didn't know how to like tackle that beast. So I had these ideas and I ended up putting it to sleep. Actually kind of became one of my first projects, so stepping stools, which ended up being in tulipwood, a different material. But I had some idea of Cork, but only when I went to Amarin did I actually learn how amazing that material is. It's amazing. I'm a full on advocate. Like they've turned me now. I'm like a
well, look, evangelical. Can we talk about why? Because it is very sustainable.
Oh, it's ridiculously sustainable. So the cork as a material itself is, to harvest cork, you have to take out the outer layer of the tree, the bark. That's actually the cork that we use. And that encourages the tree to then grow more outer layer, which means it has to draw more CO2 from the atmosphere into the tree. So every time you harvest cork, you're encouraging CO2 to be taken in from the atmosphere. In Portugal, it's illegal to cut down a cork tree. So they don't get cut down. They live for 200 plus years. So they've got these forests that are literally just hoovering in CO2. And then the material itself is extremely versatile. It's been used on the nose of rockets with NASA because of its resistance to burning. And it's, yeah, water resistant, fire resistant. It's like all of these things that are amazing. You know, when I was talking to them, they said this particular product they had, which was like an architectural grade product that they kind of bake it. So it's kind of rigid, but has all of these kind of extra properties it brings out. And they were like, if they'd used this on Grenfell Tower, the tower wouldn't have burnt down. And that's when I was like, this is when we have to start taking it seriously. This is when, like, why don't we know this? Why are we not using this more? And then I said, I really think I need to forget about those stalls that I had as an idea and start making the project about what they're doing there, because people need to learn about what cork is and what the potential of the material is beyond a nice set of stalls, really.
Well, you came up with these kind of totems.
Yeah.
They're like almost like your vases, but on steroids. I mean, why those shapes?
That's such a good description. Can I use that on my website?
Yes, you may. You may. That's Thank okay. You. Yes, absolutely.
So the reason why, so the appearance of the pieces is based on a few things. So when I was given this opportunity, they hadn't nailed down a specific location yet. So initially I was like, what I want to do is more like a pavilion. I want to do something very spatial. I want to do something like a pavilion. But if you have a pavilion, you need to know the site so you can design a specific thing in relation to that space, right? But we had no specific space yet. So then it was like, how do I design a pavilion if I don't know where it's located? So then it became, okay, I'm just going to focus on the columns. And then if you look at the language of columns and where it's linked to, so columns, you find them in temples, Grecian temples. And traditionally, columns would have been, they'd have taken like a trunk of a tree and stacked stone around them.
Right.
To make those shapes. And in the end, that is very similar to how we ended up doing it. We had in the middle of those sculptures, it's like a metal pole, and we stacked the form around it. Very much like a children's toy, actually. Don't ask me how that happened. But but the shape is coming from the idea of this column language is there, but then some of them are more feminine. The name itself alludes to this, the spirit of place, the genius loci, the concept that a space has a certain feeling that is linked to a spirit that used to protect it or give it that feeling. That's where the term comes from in architecture. And the idea is that I was bringing this feeling that I had when I went to the cork oak forest in Portugal to London. And so all of these different ingredients, the color ingredients that I had there, because I was using these quite hot reds and oranges, but actually when the bark is stripped, it's almost exactly the same. I've used almost exactly the same color. I know it seems way too vibrant, but it is this really vibrant burnt orange that the bark has. And then these lichen greens and that were in the forest. And I think the only color that I really turned up was the blue.
Right.
It was an amazing, it was February. It was amazing. Like super, I was wearing t-shirts and stuff for February. It was kind of insane. But the blue, I just made it a little bit more Kleiny. But for everything else, it pretty much was as I found it.
Because I was going to ask you about your relationship with colour, because, I mean, you've explained why the cork was the colour that it was, which is fascinating. Mm. And the exhibition was colourful. And so some of your work has a lot of colour in, and others' pieces are very neutral.
Mm. I think that's the fault of the painting, to be honest.
Okay. We blame the painting.
Yeah, we can blame everything on the painting, because at the start, all of the colours coming from the raw materials. So Ebony Revolution Collection, the colours are coming from the ebony. The colours are coming from the lignin vitae. It's coming from the metals that I'm using. If I'm using the copper in the necklace, it's the copper. Mm. And so I was very... And that's actually been interesting. I think that the materials have led me to them sometimes because of the colour. I want to use a material because it's offering me a certain tone. But when I started to paint, it was like freedom. I can use colours just because I like them, or because they make me feel a certain way. And that's, you know, wasn't afforded before. And so when I started to do that, I kind of just ran with it. It's been the painting that's given me the kind of confidence, I want to say, to start introducing colour onto surfaces instead of letting the material themselves speak. And that might be more of the architectural element, the argument with the architecture side of myself, you know, that Adolf Loos decoration is crime.
Yes.
And not wanting to over-decorate and not wanting to like be too shiny.
Technically it's ornament and crime, but I was going to ask you a bit about, that's all right. I was going to ask you a little bit about this because as I was kind of looking at your work yesterday and thinking about it, there are moments that are quite postmodern. Thinking about your architecture background, I mean, was postmodernism an influence?
It is, yeah. I think it's nice when people see it and they get it right.
Oh, thanks very much.
But, you know, it's like, and people say, do you, like, that's very deco, or that's very, it's like, it is, yeah, it is. I like architecture and it's in my work and I want it to be in there. It's part of, you know, it's definitely, as you said, it's the foundational. Well, you didn't say I said when you asked me. It's the foundational stone from which everything else is laid upon. So, yeah, it's definitely there and I'm glad you can see it. Yeah, it's good.
And you wanted to be an architect from the age of six?
Six, seven, around then. I'm not sure. Yeah. I can nail this down if I figure out when that trip to Trinidad was as a little girl. How do you know that?
Yeah. See,
that's a good one.
Stuff. Can you remember, well, I know you can remember, the moment that you decided you wanted to be an architect?
I can, yeah. We were in Trinidad. We'd gone over, because my dad's Trinidadian and he took the whole family over. I'm one of three girls. So me, my mom, dad, sisters went over to Trinidad and it was amazing for me. I was climbing all the trees, doing all the naughty things and staying in lots of different places, but always so hot. Like literally everywhere was so hot. And I remember going to one house with my family and saying to my dad, "Dad, how come this one house is so cool? Why is it so cool in here?" And he said, it's because my cousin designed it and he's an architect. And I was like, that's amazing. If you can do something to make spaces nice and more livable, I want to do that. Mm. That's the kind of thought that was in my brain. It was like, yeah, if you can do this, I want to do that. And so I had it in my head since I was very little that I was going to design homes for people to live in and just nice homes. That was my idea.
What did your parents do, Simone?
My dad was a computer programmer. He studied physics at university and became a computer programmer. And my mum is probably the reason I do so many different things. She was a dental nurse and then she went on to become a counsellor. And she worked in rehousing the homeless and stuff like that, worked with vulnerable children. But I looked at her and saw someone who was competent and confident in herself enough to change careers and just do it. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I do change what I do every 2 weeks. It's because of her.
Was it a creative house growing up?
When we were little, my mum made all of the clothes. Because she studied tailoring as well. She studied tailoring and she decided not to go through with it because she said people don't respect how long it takes to make clothes. They think it's really quick and it shouldn't cost as much as it does. And that's actually what you hear a lot of craft people say, like, it takes a long time to make this, but no one wants to pay. And I guess I heard it from her first without even knowing. But she was very good with making. And I think they always encouraged me to draw. I liked drawing when I was little. And my older sister's an amazing drawer. And my younger sister says she's not that creative, but she makes the most amazing cakes as well. So it's like, I feel like I did grow up in a creative house, but I didn't know I grew up in a creative house. It was normal. All of the creativity was normal. We painted shirts for going to carnival, you know. We'd get shirts and paint big. I remember when I was little, big tropical fishes on the front with a Jamaican flag and a Trinidadian flag, because those are the countries my parents are from. And we each got to paint our own shirt. And like, I had that until it couldn't fit me anymore. You know, it was normal though. It was just a fun thing to do, and it was encouraged.
And you got to the Bartlett in London to study architecture.
I did.
Did you enjoy the experience?
No, I didn't. Many reasons. I blame my secondary school. It was too much of a good school. When I was at that school, they made me feel that the world was my oyster. And I went to the Bartlett and I felt like, is it really my oyster? It was tough. I was from a very multicultural school, and I went to the Bartlett and I think I was one of three people of color, and they didn't really know what to do with me. And I made really good friends, but I think it was not what I was expecting it to be. It's a weird, and it's super competitive and super hard. And it's just, architecture is actually really hard anyway. So that was already a thing. But then the transition into, I think that, to put it in a very brief way, that was the first time I really felt like I was black.
Right.
When I went to university. And that was weird because I'd grown up my whole life black, and so why do I suddenly feel it now? So there was a lot of emotional stuff going on that had nothing to do with design, but was taking up a lot of space and energy. And then on top of that, it's extremely competitive. Like I said, hanging up your work in front of people and learning how to do all of the actual architecture stuff of it was hard. But I got through it, and I think I got through it because I was lucky enough to have a supportive family and a mum who drove me in on the day of the hand-in, because she said, you're going to hand in this work, Simone. You're going to do it. And so I did. Yeah.
Mm. But you decided not to stay in architecture education. You did design products at the Royal College.
Yeah, but that wasn't on purpose.
Right.
This is something that we need to be more transparent about, I think, as an industry to our up-and-coming generation. No one has a straight line journey. And if they do, it's pretty boring. And that doesn't mean it's always nice to not have a straight line. I definitely didn't always want it to be as up and down as mine has been. But if we normalize it, maybe we can be better prepared for the fact that things aren't going in a straight line when they aren't. So I studied architecture, and where I flourished was every year they have a project that asks you to make something, to work with materials, because architects should know how materials actually work so that we can design with them appropriately. So I designed, well, the first year I made this really sculptural thing that could be worn and taken to a site and then interact with something on site. And it kind of blew everyone's mind. And for me, it kind of blew my mind, but it also felt really natural. And every year when I did that brief, that making brief, I always did the best for myself, but also like one of the best projects out of everyone who was there. And so I was kind of like, I really like making. Just ignore it. That's not happening. You're going to be an architect. Be very serious about this. And then I went to one of these preparing for practice lectures, which is what you do when you're out working in the field and you come back quarterly to do these lectures. And they said, the lecturer said something like, you might not even want to be an architect. You might want to go to the Royal College of Art and do something like design products. And I was like, okay, that sounds like what I want to do. So it still wasn't meant to be a switch. It was meant to be me going to design products to get it out of my system. It was like, you were young. I graduated when I was 21. You've got time. You can go there, do a 2-year master's, make as much as you like, learn as much as you like from all the different departments as possible, and then go back to architecture with a leg up because you'll have all of this like making knowledge. You'd have looked into all of the vehicle design and the ceramics and the metalwork, and you'll have all of this knowledge that's going to make you an even better architect. And I went there and I did that. I went in every department. I got like tutorials with Michael Rowe.
I was going to say Michael Rowe seems to have been quite an important character I've read elsewhere.
He is amazing, but he's amazing because he's generous. I mean, he's amazing as a maker, right? Mm. In his own, he's his own thing. But I just turned up, knocked on the door and was like, can anyone talk to me? You're not meant to do that. At least phone ahead and book. I literally turned up and he was like, okay, come in. What have you got there? And we ended up having quite a few of these tutorials. And he kept on saying, are you sure you're in the right department? You don't want to be in the jewelry metalwork department. And I was like, no, I'm in the right place. So he saw something I didn't know was there. But he had the time for me, which is really important. I don't know if we have enough time for people just as people anymore. He had that. And I went and I just had this time. I went into the vehicle design department. The guys there showed me how to model in clay. I went into the ceramics and glass department, learned that. Show some respect. You cannot learn ceramics and glass by walking into a department. That was some serious shit. That's some serious shit, man. But yeah, it was really fun. And I went everywhere that they'd let me in, basically. Yeah, yeah. And I learned as much as I could. And then when I left, it was like, and now I have to go back into a room at a desk and like draw door plans or something. I don't know. It just wasn't going to happen. I just carried on working and making and learning. And yeah,
I found this manifesto that you wrote at the Royal College.
Yeah.
Which design and war are not compatible. Design is war. War is design. I'm at war with my time, with history, with all authority that resides in fixed and frightened forms. I'm one of millions who do not fit in, who has no home, no doctrine, nor firm place to call my own. I declare war on all icons and finalities, on all histories that would chain me with my own falseness. I'm a constructor of worlds, a sensualist who worships the flesh. Today, I commence the construction of a city. Do you still feel that way?
I like that question because you just read that all out and just dropped that on me. So let's be clear from the start. So that manifesto was based on a writing by Libius Woods. So Libius Woods wrote something about architecture and war.
Mm.
And I read it and I was like, this is too good. This is just too, it just resonated. It was like inside of me. I was like vibrating after I read that. And then we were asked to write, everyone has to write these end of year statements. And I was like, I'm rewriting that in my voice. And I just wrote that piece that you just read. And I think sometimes you drill into a part of yourself that you don't know. Like I jumped ahead in time when I wrote that. I would have been 23 when I wrote that. And I think I'm just about living that 23-year-old's intent now, which is
interesting.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating that because, I mean, as you say, you've shown painting at the Royal Academy, jewellery at Collect, the Crafts Council exhibition, furniture at the Museum of London. Did it take you a long time after you left the Royal College to work out where you fitted in?
I don't fit in. Where do I fit in, Grant?
I don't know. You tell
exactly.
me.
Exactly. I don't fit anywhere. I literally don't. When I fit in, I'll tell you, I don't fit anywhere. No one knows what to do with me till now. Part of the reason I'm here is because when I left uni, I just wanted to get a job and no one knew what to do with me. They were like, I'd be in an interview with an architecture practice and they'd be like, this is literally something I heard. We really like your portfolio. It's great. We're just going to have a think about what to do with you because you've got that master's and you've got the experience working here and here and you've got your part one, but you're not officially a part two, but you're not a part one, are you? Because you know how to do these things. So they're having this conversation and they literally don't know where to put me. And that, so many rooms I've been in where I've heard that. And I think at some point I realized, a part of me realized I was going to have to start doing shit myself. And that's when I started to do work with Flock, which was some like shows that I did for London Design Festival.
Well, Flock was a collective you formed.
Yeah, it was, yeah. With Pinilla Orsted, friend of mine from architecture, Raquel Damash Martins, who's now in Portugal. No, she's in Amsterdam, but she's a product designer, and Catherine Anyango, who's an illustration artist. We formed it, and then we put on shows, and part of the premise, we were only going to show other female creatives. There's a bigger story to that reasoning, but it was what I did, and part of the reason I did that was because I just didn't fit anywhere else, but I didn't want to stop showing my work. Yeah, so that was an important step for me.
Simone, our time is kind of up, really, which is a shame because I thoroughly enjoyed myself. I mean, congratulations.
Cheers.
On a brilliant year. 24. Can you top it? What are your plans?
Got a few collaborations in the pipework already. I think, in honesty, it would be nice to find a gallery to work with so I didn't have to do so much of the legwork myself. Like, it's crazy, but what's been great is plugging into bigger systems that are established, so I didn't have to spend so much time trying to amplify my work this year because I was collaborating with people who were happy to do that for me. So for me, that gallery would be great. But I'm got some painting commissions lined up. I've got a project coming out with Habitat. But I can't say more than that. Just look out for it next year. And I will be, I've got some new work, like personal work that I'll be coming out with, three-dimensional stuff. Yeah. So it's happening. But that's all after the sleep. The sleep has to come first.
Yes. Get your sleep. Get your sleep over Christmas. Be nice and refreshed for next year. Yeah, it was complete joy as ever to talk to you, Simone. Thank you so much for your time.
Cheers.
To find out more about Simone, go to simonebrewster.co.uk. And remember, if you've listened to all 106 episodes of Material Matters and you're looking for more material inspiration, then I heartily recommend Words on Wood from Ahek and Desenio. It investigates how multiple industries meet through wood, a subject that's right up my street. The full season is out now in all the usual places. Go listen. As ever, to find other podcasts that I've done and to sign up to our newsletter, go to materialmatters.design. And there are images relating to the interviews on our Instagram page, which is also materialmatters.design. Finally, this is really important too. If you've enjoyed listening and want to see this podcast flourish, then please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this from. And it would make me incredibly happy if you went to my Patreon page and made a pledge at patreon.com/materialmatters. For as little as £2.50 a month, you can receive an invite to various Material Matters events, as well as getting access to each episode before it's published to the wider world. Material Matters is a completely independent concern, and any help you could offer would be hugely appreciated. Ultimately, you'll be helping to take the message of the importance of materials, skill, craft, and design to a whole new audience. Thanks very much for listening, and have a very happy new year.